This is a topic, sexuality and gender. It's a topic that I care a lot about. I have a bunch of friends who would identify within these categories of LGBTIQ, and also, yeah, members of my family. It's something that I've thought a lot about as well. I studied it a little bit at university. Actually, one of my brothers is a gender studies lecturer and researcher. So it's something that we have a lot of family conversations over the dinner table about. So it's something that I've considered greatly. And I also think it's something that youth are interested in. It's something that often teenagers in our church and in our youth ministry ask about. And so that's part of why I'm up here speaking and it's not Jordan doing the third one. But also, yeah, I'm doing this because Jordan asked me and I like Jordan. He's a nice guy. That's good. I thought I'd just say what this sermon is not going to be on. This is not a sermon about politics. I'm not talking about the postal vote or any other kind of political issue. It's not a sermon about what's already been covered. I'm not going to be rehashing old ground and talking about the same sorts of things that Jordan's already talked about. But it's worth saying that I do agree with the points that he's made, and I want to affirm what's already been shared. I wasn't actually at the previous two services, but I listened to the sermons online, and I thought they were all right. So thanks, Jordan. It's also worth saying that I'm not going to be doing a really detailed exegesis of the passage. I'm not going to be telling you all the fine details and intricacies of the Greek. I've actually preached on this passage before at youth camp last year. This is going to be a completely different sermon from that one. Because this is thematic, I'm going to be talking about this topic. I'm going to jump around a little bit. I'm going to look at some different Bible verses, and I would really encourage you to write them down and look them up and tell me if you think that I've used them incorrectly. I'm really open to that, but I'm not going to be going into each one in huge detail. I'm more just going to be talking about the topic with reference to different parts of the Bible. The title that we have tonight is How Do We Show Grace? And I think I'm just going to kind of focus that in a little bit, and I'm going to talk about, actually, how do we show love to people? So I'm interpreting that question as, how do we show love to people, particularly who are LGBTI? And I'm speaking tonight particularly to people who are not LGBTI. Okay, so this sermon is for people who are not same-sex attracted and who are not gender questioning. So people that would be what's often referred to as heterosexual and cisgender. That's who I'm talking to. But I do want to acknowledge that there are people here tonight who are LGBTI, would identify with those categories, or might be same-sex attracted, or might be questioning their gender. But it's just that I actually think that on this topic, how do we love people? I think that in this area, it's something that people who are heterosexual and cisgender, those are the ones that probably need to think a little bit more about it and need to hear about it. So when I was in high school, I had a friend. Can you believe it? I had a friend. We were once walking home from school. I went to Borwin High, and so I lived in North Borwin. We were going for a stroll. I think it was probably in year eight. And we were talking about sexuality. And she asked me, she said, what do you think about same-sex attraction? And I said to her, you know, I don't think it's wrong to be attracted to someone of the same gender, of the same sex. But I do think that it's not God's intention for us to act on that. You know, I don't think it's God's intention for us to be in same-sex relationships. And so she asked me, she said, Chris, why do you hate gay people? And I was like, what? What do you mean? That's not what I meant. I felt really blindsided. I was like, I don't hate them. What do you mean? I don't hate gay people. That was kind of how she'd interpreted what I'd said, but it wasn't what I'd meant. And I think this summarizes many Christians' experience of speaking with their friends about sexuality and about gender, is that there's a perception in our culture that Christians don't do a great job of loving people who are LGBTI. There's often a perception that we might actually be hateful or aggressive towards them. Is this correct? You know, we know it's a Christian idea to love people. So in Mark chapter 12, verse 31, it says, love your neighbour as yourself. We all know this one, right? This is a really basic Christian thing. We're supposed to love. We're supposed to be people defined by love. We're supposed to love anyone irrespective of whether we like them or not, whether they annoy us, whether they're Christian, non-Christian, straight, gay, lesbian, bisexual, intersex, transgender, cisgender, everyone. But our culture believes that we don't. And we can think of extreme cases, I think, where it's really obvious that people who identify as Christians have not always been completely loving to people. I watched a documentary recently called, I think it was called The Most Hated Family in America. I don't know, has anyone seen that before? It's by a guy called Louis Theroux, and it's about this American family, which is kind of like a house church, and all of their kind of missional action is basically about going out on the streets and telling people how much God hates them. So they'll go to people's funerals and they have these placard signs. I won't tell you exactly what they say, but they basically say, God hates you, God hates people, and particularly God hates gay people. This is how they spend their whole lives. And this guy made a really fascinating documentary about why does this happen? What is motivating these people? And I think this is kind of a bit of a stereotype, but there's also kind of a hard reality to it as well, right? People who identify as Christians have not always done a great job of loving people who are LGBTI. And there's some very prominent cases in the media of really extreme acts of hatred sometimes, which are disturbing. And I think these extreme cases are often cited as evidence that the church does not do a good job of loving people. Now, it's easy for us to say, you know, I haven't beaten anybody up. I haven't gone and, you know, shown offensive signs at someone's funeral telling people that God hates them. You know, I haven't kicked anyone out of their house or, you know, made them quit their job or bullied them or anything like that. We're sort of saying we're not doing these extreme things, right? I think that's often our response. You know, it's easy to say, I'm not like that. Just like my friend said, Chris, why do you hate gay people? I said, well, I don't. What do you mean? I want to look at this passage that we read earlier, 1 Corinthians chapter 13, and particularly this part, verses 4 to 7. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It's not proud. It doesn't dishonor others. It's not self-seeking. It's not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Paul is trying to answer the question here, what is love? What does it mean to love God? What does it mean to love your neighbor? This is a question that we should have as Christians. And he's trying to tell us what it looks like to love. And he's saying to the church here, he's saying, love is more important than ministry. It's more important than being a great teacher. It's more important than even faith and hope, he says. It's more important than generosity. It's more important than supernatural expressions of the Spirit. So we could have the best bands, the best preachers, the best youth group, the best mission teams, the best building, the best camps, the best food, the best prayer times, but if we don't have love, it's a waste. That is what Paul is saying here. That's the big message of this passage. For church, love is the main thing. Now imagine if you met somebody who treated you like this all of the time, 100% of the time. They were completely patient, completely kind. They never envy you. They didn't boast. They weren't proud. They didn't dishonor you. They were always seeking your best interests. They never got angry at you. They didn't keep any record of wrongs. They were always, you know, excited by truth. They always protected you. They trusted you. They hoped for you, and they persevered always. Imagine somebody who was that loving, who treated you like that. You would not doubt that they loved you if they treated you in all of these ways. You couldn't. If we were perfectly loving, I think that our culture would know it. People won't always accept your love. They won't always want your love. But if we're perfectly loving, it can't be doubted that people doubt it. How do we actually go with these things? I'm going to go through them one by one, briefly. Patience. Do you get frustrated with your friends who are same-sex attracted? Do you listen to them more than you talk at them? Kindness. Do we publicly criticize gay people? When a friend makes a joke at somebody's expense, do we laugh along? Envy. Do we wish that we had the sexual freedom that our bisexual friend has? Do we wish that we could live the life that they live? Boasting and pride. Do we tell our lesbian friends that straight people are much better parents? Do we tell them how great marriage is and how they're missing out? Honor. Do we ignore transgender people? Or do we find ways to encourage and affirm them? Self-seeking. Do we think about what homosexual people need? Or are we mostly concerned about how they affect us and our family? Anger. Is our tone gentle or aggressive on issues of sexuality and gender? Do we feel bitterness in our hearts? Keeping a record of wrongs. Do we keep bringing up historical events that we think that LGBTI people are responsible for? Do we blame them for social problems? Delighting in evil. Have you ever taken enjoyment in the suffering of a gay person? Have you ever heard of an act of violence toward them and thought they deserved it? Have you ever made jokes at their expense? Rejoicing in truth. Do we seek to understand what the Bible teaches about sexuality and gender? Do we seek to understand the experiences of intersex people? Protection. Would you be willing to stand up to your friends who are picking on a transgender person at your school? Would you step in if you saw someone being beaten on the street? Are you willing to put yourselves in harm's way to protect a transgender person? Trust. Would you let your bisexual friend look after your house while you were away on holiday? Do you assume the worst about people's motives? Do you share your vulnerabilities? Hope. Do we think that LGBTI people can be saved? Do we think that they're less likely to have faith than other people? Do we think of them as being part of a special, particularly sinful category of people? Perseverance. Do we make relationships with LGBTI people a priority in our lives, or do we avoid them because it feels uncomfortable? That's a lot of questions. What I'm trying to suggest here is that, look, maybe we haven't been extremely hateful, but have we been extremely loving? Maybe we haven't completely messed up, but if we're being completely honest, none of us are 100% patient, kind, humble, generous, selfless, self-controlled, forgiving, good, protective, trusting, hopeful, and perseverant. Maybe our problem is not extreme aggression, but just everyday apathy. When you love somebody, you go out of your way for them. Have we gone out of our way to care for people? Do we even know any LGBTI people? We may not have hated people, but we might have treated them with distance. Would you welcome a lesbian couple to have dinner at your house? Would you start a conversation with the transgender individual who you see around your neighbourhood? I want to suggest that we aren't as loving as we could be. We haven't done a perfect job. And the reason for that is because none of us are perfectly loving people. I think that if we were perfectly loving, people would have no doubt that we love them. Now, it's not our job to convince people that we love them. It's our job to be so loving that they can't help but be convinced. We want to treat people in such a way that there is no doubt in their minds. That's what this passage is calling us to. It's calling us to an enormous, supernatural, impossible kind of love. One way that we can love people is actually in how we communicate with them. So, moving further back in time, once upon a time, I was in primary school. Can you believe it, youth? I know it's pretty unbelievable. Once I was this little Chris. That's what people used to call me. Nah, that never happened. I was never little. but when I was in primary school, I did have an abnormally deep voice for a child. You might have noticed that I have a deep voice now. But I still had a pretty deep voice as a child. And when I was in class, particularly in grade six, I remember, I would be sitting there in class and I'd be chatting with my friends. And there'd be like maybe, you know, 10 people in the class chatting. And the teacher would be like, Chris, stop talking. And I was like, what? Why are you singling me out? Why are you telling me off? You know, why not the whole class? Everyone's talking. Why me? You know, it felt unjust. I felt picked on. And I really resented my teacher for it. You know, I thought she was a really cruel person. I thought she was a terrible person because she was always picking on me. You know, she was always telling me off. And I think now it's probably just because I think my voice would just carry across the room. You can imagine all these shrill primary school voices, and then you've just kind of got Barry White in the corner, and it's just, you know, can't control it. I'm sorry. You think about this, if you had a group of children and you always told off the one same child, they're going to think one of two things. They're either going to think, you know, my teacher is particularly bad, they're an evil person, that's what I thought. Or they're going to think, I'm particularly bad, I'm much worse than everybody else here because I always get told off. You know, I think that as the church, we've been very vocal about sin. Historically, we've been very public telling people that they're sinful. And what's happened is that people start thinking, well, look, either I'm really bad or you are. You know, either I'm a terrible person or you religious people are. That's what it seems like. While I was preparing for this sermon, I had a conversation with a friend of mine. So I live in Blackburn South, which is a couple of suburbs away. I don't know why there's three Blackburns. Why can't we just be united, guys? You know, everyone together. But I live in Blackburn South, and I sometimes go for a walk around my neighbourhood, and I'll go for a walk in the parks. I really like walking in parks, particularly in summer. It's really nice, and the weather's getting a bit better, and so it's like I can go outside again. But occasionally when I'm walking in the park, I'll meet somebody who lives in the neighbourhood. And a while ago, I think it was probably maybe like February or March, I was wandering around Blackburn South, and I was in the park, and I, you know, said hi to this old bloke, and we had a bit of a chat. All right, we'll just call him Old Mate. That's the name we'll give him. So I met Old Mate around my neighbourhood, and you know, we just talked about, oh, where do you live? What do you do with yourself? That sort of thing. It's a little small talk, and we found out we both like gardening. Okay, so I like to do a bit of work in the garden sometimes. And so, you know, he'd share about what's he doing with his potatoes, and I'd share about, you know, trying to remove all the weeds so that I can plant some potatoes. And, you know, so we sort of bonded a little bit over this. And I'd always see him because he always goes for a walk at the same time every morning. He's wandering around. And so I'd go out and I'd be going for a stroll and I'd run into him and we'd have a chat. And I found out after a while that he's gay. And he's an older guy, so I reckon he'd be in his 60s or his 70s. And I was asking him a little bit about his experience of religion and of Christianity throughout his life. And yeah, he had some interesting things to share. And I told him that I was going to be giving this talk, and I said, you know, what do you think about religious people, about Christian people, and about their views on homosexuality? And he said to me, look, Chris, why would I listen to Christians about sexuality? You know, Christians are so broken. The church is so broken. You know, people are telling me that I'm wrong, that I'm a sinner. And then I see in the news there's all these cases of sexual abuse in the church. What is going on? How hypocritical. Why would I listen to the church? He said to me, you know, being heterosexual, it doesn't make a good marriage necessarily. It doesn't mean that you're definitely going to be a good parent. It definitely doesn't make you a good person. You know, I have Christians telling me that I'm a bad person, and then I hear about people who've been kicked out by their parents while they're in high school because they came out as gay. Where's the love in that? And honestly, I couldn't argue with him. Why would our culture listen to us when our own denomination is being investigated for numerous cases of sexual abuse? It's a hard question to answer. So you might be thinking now, Chris, are you saying that we should never tell people about sin? Are you saying that we should never talk to people about sin in their life? No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that we need to change the you to a we. Okay? Explain what I mean by that. So, in Luke chapter 18, verse 19, this little tagline, no one is good except God alone. Right, again, this is just like a Christian basic, right? No one is good. We're all sinners. We're all selfish. We've all tried to be the kings of our little kingdoms. So how vocal have we been about our own sin? When you say to somebody, you're a sinner, without adding, and I am too, it's going to sound hypocritical. When we mention other people's sinfulness, you know, when we say to somebody, you're a sinner, we need to be ready to say, we are too. We need to give examples. We need to be honest. We need to be ready to acknowledge our sin. If we speak about other people's sin without mentioning our own, they're going to feel singled out. If we tell people how sinful they are, but we also say how sinful we are, then they'll know it's nothing personal. We need to mention our own sin first so that people don't feel attacked. You know, it's when you think that somebody's saying to you, I'm better than you, that's when you feel attacked. That's when you feel threatened. That's when you feel hated. It's when you think that somebody's comparing yourself to them and saying, I'm better. So we need to make it really clear that we don't think that we're any better than anybody else. But actually, you know, I would expect that Christians would be particularly sinful people, because why else would we want to be in the church? Why else would we want the gospel? Why else would we need Jesus? We need to explain that better to people. One of my mentors, Rowan, he always used to ask the question, what part of the gospel do people need to hear at this time? So he had this idea that it's kind of a slow burn. When you're doing evangelism, you kind of give people pieces at a time. You know, I don't know if that's a rule necessarily, but that was his approach. And he said to me, you know, like he was like, well, people might have heard that they're sinners, but they might actually need to know that they're loved. And I think it's a little bit like this with the LGBTI community. Often we've told them that they're sinners, but we haven't told them enough that they're loved. We need to do a better job of that. And too often we've demonstrated the opposite of love. We need to be so loving that people can't help but notice. Now, some people might actually ask, is it possible for us to be a welcoming place? Is it possible for us to be a loving place? And I have friends who say to me that the church is just inherently hostile towards same-sex attracted people and towards gender-questioning people. You know, they would say, Chris, it's just not possible. Your church cannot love people in that way. I think we can. I want to say, actually, I think it is possible for us to be loving and welcoming to LGBTI people. One space that I've actually seen this at work was in my previous church. So before I was leading at St. Alfred's, I went to a previous church in Caulfield, and I was leading in a youth group there. Okay, and a number of the youth were LGBTI. So it was about a third of the youth group, if you can imagine that, were same-sex attracted or gender questioning. Okay, and they would come along to our youth group for a number of reasons. I think one was it was fun, but another reason was actually that they had adults there who cared for them and who looked out for them. It was a safe place. It was kind of interesting because a lot of them had been bullied at school, but church was the safe place. Okay? They liked coming because we cared. We were open about the Bible. We didn't try and hide anything. We were honest about what we thought about sexuality and about sexual ethics. We didn't keep that a secret. We had a lot of conversations with people about it. But we tried as hard as we could to love them unconditionally. We didn't always do a perfect job, but they kept coming along. And that experience has made me believe that it is possible to make a space and to be a community where LGBTI people can be loved, that is a Christian community and a Christian space. I think it is possible because I feel like I've seen it, you know. I want to give you a few tips about how we can do this, how we can make our church and our community a safe space, how we can be loving people, all right? Because it can sound a bit hypothetical, a bit like, oh, these are the nice virtues, but how does that happen? So the first thing that I want to say is we need to assume that people are in pain. I don't know if you're aware, but people who are LGBTI are much more likely to experience psychological distress than people who aren't. So here's a few stats from some different Australian studies. So LGBTI people are twice as likely to experience a mental health concern. They're 14 times more likely to attempt suicide. If you meet a transgender person, there is a 50-50 chance that at some point in their life they have attempted to kill themselves. So huge stats. Particularly at risk are people that are bisexual, transgender, intersex, and anybody who's a woman who falls within one of these categories. They have much higher incidences of attempted suicide and of mental health concerns. We need to assume that people are actually doing it tough. If you're speaking with an LGBTI person, you're probably speaking with somebody who's had a pretty tough life. Okay. And not only that, you're probably speaking with somebody who's actually experienced a lot of harassment. So, studies suggest that up to about 50% have experienced some sort of public insult about their sexuality or gender. 18%, like one in five, have experienced physical harassment or violence. And the most common place that this happens is at school. If somebody's going to be verbally abused or physically abused because of their gender or sexuality, that's more likely to happen at school than anywhere else. So youth, you guys actually have a great opportunity to be protecting your friends, be looking out for your friends in this area. Because of these things, I actually believe that our first response and our main response needs to be care and compassion. We need to assume that people are in pain and we need to treat them gently and kindly. The second thing is that we need to make sure that we don't assume that we know what it's like. Okay. So have you ever had something really tragic happen in your life? Has there ever been a time when, say, you know, a family member has passed away or there's been some other personal tragedy and you've had a friend come to you and they said, I know what you're going through. I know how it feels. I've been there, mate, you know. I know exactly what's going on. And you just think, no, you don't. You don't know what it's like to be me. You don't know what my pain is like. You know, I don't know about you, but I get a bit defensive when people say that, when they say, I know what you're going through, you know. Because every person's experience is unique. You know, I don't know what somebody else's life is like. I haven't been in their shoes, really. So we need to make sure that we don't assume that we know what it's like for other people. So here's a verse from Proverbs chapter 18. To answer before listening, that is folly and shame. It's wise to listen first and then speak. We need to hear people's stories before we share our opinions. That's what Proverbs has to say. We need to ask. You know, Jesus was somebody who always listened to the stories of people who are in pain, people who are suffering. If you go through the Gospels and read a lot of the stories of him physically healing people, more often than not, he'll get them to share a little bit about their life. Or he supernaturally already knows. Jesus was interested in finding out people's stories and how they got to where they were at. And we need to be the same. Before we tell people, we need to get to know them. And another way of just listening to people and just showing them respect in this area is actually about the names that we use for people. So obviously there's the thing of like avoiding stereotypes and avoiding offensive words or offensive labels for people. I think that kind of goes without saying. But sometimes people will have names that they prefer. So sometimes people who are transgender or people who are, you know, within some of these other categories will have a name that they've taken on, or they may have even changed their name. There's a member of my family who changed their name because of their gender identity. Okay, and I can remember, to kind of demonstrate this point a little bit, when I was younger, when I was in high school, I've had a few nicknames, and they generally revolved around being quite tall. I had one guy who used to call me Humungoid. So you can call me that if you like. No, please don't. Another one is Bigfoot. I've got size 15 shoes, so that's why. I do have to order them online, so it's a bit annoying. So Bigfoot. I think Judge, Jury and Executioner, that's another one. also, I had a woodwork teacher. I used to do woodwork. He used to call me Durry. So Durry is like slang term for a cigarette. And he was a pretty, you know, ochre Aussie bloke. I'd come into class and be like, ah, you're getting lit, Durry. Yeah. He's a funny guy. But it gets old pretty quick, you know. When people call you names that you don't prefer, especially when it's offensive, it's just a matter of respect, right? If somebody has a name that they prefer, use it. It's a simple thing. It's a respect thing. The next thing is, it's my third practical advice. Don't expect people to live according to Christian morality if they're not Christians. Okay. So if somebody hasn't yet committed to faith, we shouldn't expect them to live in the way that a Christian does. This is Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. What business is it of mine to judge those outside the church? Presumably the answer is none. It's not my business to judge people outside the church. If somebody's not yet a Christian, we shouldn't expect them to live as a Christian. And if we really believe in Christianity, you know, we understand that people need the Holy Spirit to change. Right? It's actually impossible to live according to Christian morality first without the Spirit. So it would just be crazy for us to expect people to live in a Christian way when they're not yet a Christian. It's not possible for them to. Another way to think about it is you can't hold someone accountable to something that they haven't committed to, right? We can't expect people to be Christians and kind of pull them up and be like, or live as Christians, be like, hey, mate, why are you doing that? Why are you acting in that way? They haven't committed to doing that. Why would we expect that? We need to actually be the kind of community that welcomes people who have not yet committed to faith, leaving aside how they're currently living. Right? We need to be a community that loves people so well that they're compelled to consider Christ. Because that's how people become Christians, right? So can I ask here, if you think about when you became a Christian, put up your hand if before you became a Christian, before you first really understood grace and the gospel, you were already part of a Christian community. So let's just have a look around. That's, I think, pretty much everyone, almost everyone, right? The way that people become Christians is through being part of a Christian community before they're Christians, right? So we need to have a bit of space for people to be part of our community and to be loved before they've made a faith commitment and not expect them to live in the way that we do. It would be unreasonable for us to expect that. Another way to think about it is this. It's not sexual ethics that saves people. It's Jesus. All right? Which kind of brings me to my last point. So there's this amazing passage in Isaiah, which I really love. The youth have had a lot of Isaiah in the last term, so sorry, guys, to give you a little bit more. This is a passage from Isaiah, which we didn't read in our Bible study. So Isaiah 56, "Let no eunuch complain, I'm only a dry tree. For this is what the Lord says, to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths, who choose what pleases me and hold fast to my covenant, to them I will give within my temple and its walls a memorial and a name better than sons and daughters. I'll give them an everlasting name that will endure forever." It's talking about eunuchs. So a eunuch was somebody in ancient Middle Eastern culture who'd had part or all of their genitals removed. So it was a guy who'd had their testicles taken off, basically. It's usually happened before puberty. Why am I talking about eunuchs? Well, like intersex people, they had a different physical biology from most men and women. They were thought of as not being complete men. But they also weren't women, sort of a third gender category in those days. Like transgender people, they had different gender roles from what people traditionally thought of men having. You know, they often worked in high levels of government. They often worked looking after women and children who were the family of wealthy and powerful men. So they had specific gender roles unique to being a eunuch. Like lesbian, gay, and bisexual people, they actually had a really different sexual experience from most people as well. So they had much, not necessarily same-sex desire, but actually much reduced sexual desire, or none at all. This is a passage that expresses an eternal hope for people whose gender or sexuality is different from the norm, who don't quite fit within our traditional categories of what it means to be a man or what it means to be a woman. I think it's amazing that this is in the Bible and encouraging. It talks about a legacy better than sons and daughters, an everlasting name that will endure forever. You know, we started this sermon with the question, which I kind of reinterpreted, but the question, how do we show grace, right? How do we show grace? And I want to say a primary way to show grace is to tell people about it, right? If we believe that Jesus is who he says he is, if we believe that God has a memorial and a name better than sons and daughters for people, that God has in mind for people an everlasting name that's going to endure forever, it would be unloving for us not to tell people about it. That sounds pretty good to me. What people need most is not Christian sexual ethics, but Jesus. That's where we've got to start. It's about God's grace. Through showing love and through sharing God's good news, we let the Spirit convict people, we let the Spirit change people. Our job is to love people and to share God's good news with them. I'm going to finish there, and I'm going to pray for us, guys. Let's do it. God, I just want to thank you for the opportunity I've had tonight to share about this really challenging topic and to just skim over some really deep passages about these sorts of things. God, I pray that you just keep giving us a deep desire to understand your word and what it is that you have to say about gender and about sexuality and what it is that you have to say about love. God, I pray that you would give us a passion to love anybody irrespective of who they are or what their experience has been. God, I pray that we'd be able to put into practice these different practices, these different things that we've been considering tonight of how to show love to people, how to show grace to people. God, I pray that we would have courage to connect with people even when it's uncomfortable, and that we'd have courage to share your good news even when it's uncomfortable. In Jesus' name, amen.